ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Global roaming is expanding to weekdays.
We did try to stay weekly. The news said no. So 5 days a week it is.
It's serious reporting on global events. Plus you're invited for a daily radio coffee table chat with me, Geraldine Doogue.
And with me, Hamish McDonald. And in 2026, Latika Burke and Kylie Morris.
Together we'll explore the global forces reshaping our world in mostly calm conversation.
Calm, Geraldine. Global roaming. Search for Global Roaming on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Priya, you're a much more assiduous exerciser than me, even though I do exercise. I get on my bike. And you do this thing. I mean, you keep on inviting me, but I'm too scared to say yes. What's cardio tennis?
So can we be honest with everybody that we've moved meeting? We're always honest, but we've moved our health report meeting to facilitate my cardio tennis sessions.
Oh, is that why you have a sheen?
Yes, on our meetings, that's why.
Right, okay.
I've been running around to disco music, Norman, with a bunch of friends where the coach makes us hit balls, do skills, but run. Great for bone density and the brain. And I recently said to you, and I mean it, it is possibly one of the best changes I've made in my life. I love my Pilates, my walking, all the other stuff, but this is childlike joy for me. I love it.
So you come out joyful.
Come and join me, Norman. Everyone wants to see us doing a cardio tennis or Pilates session together.
All
come
right.
on.
We'll do it.
Yeah. We'll wear matching outfits too.
Maybe not. Exercise and your mental health is coming up on the Health Report.
I'm Priya Alexander on Wurundjeri Land.
And I'm Norman Swan on Gadigal Land.
Also on the show, a new framework for respectful maternal and newborn care in Victoria. We'll explore why it was even needed in the first place.
After a heart attack, what drugs should you be taking to prevent another one? New research could change the story.
First in the news, we're back onto Alzheimer's dementia and the potential link with herpes simplex virus, or HSV.
So just to remind people what we're talking about here, in the last couple of years, people have shown that if you have the shingles vaccine, it seems to reduce the risk of dementia maybe by 17 or 20%. And the theory behind that was, well, maybe it's preventing herpes resurgence in the brain that's doing that. Then other vaccines seem to show it as well, the pneumococcal vaccine, the influenza vaccine. So is it the vaccine? Is it the virus? And this study kind of goes towards whether or not herpes is involved.
So these researchers have done a randomised clinical trial. They've used valacyclovir, which people might know because you can access these kinds of antivirals if you've got shingles, which is quite painful. They've used this medication on the hypothesis, that link that you've just talked about, that these viruses are somehow part of Alzheimer's dementia and the worsening of cognitive function. They've got a group of older adults, 120 participants. They've got a diagnosis of dementia.
Early dementia.
Of early dementia. They've also got what we call seroconversion. So they've had evidence of herpes simplex 1 or 2. They've had exposure to it, perhaps cold sores or genital herpes before. And they've given half the group the valacyclovir and half of the group they haven't given it. And unfortunately, there was no evidence that being on the antiviral therapy actually slowed the deterioration in cognition.
So they don't recommend it for cognitive impairment or early Alzheimer's disease, which is very different from the situation in those studies of vaccines. So it doesn't mean that herpes isn't involved in Alzheimer's disease. It could just mean that by the time you've got early Alzheimer's disease, the treatment's not going to remove the herpes. In other words, the herpes has started the process, and once you've started the process, it's got its own momentum, whereas the vaccine is upstream, if you like, of that before the Alzheimer's has actually shown itself.
And I think it's also a reminder that something like Alzheimer's dementia is so multifactorial and complex that it might not just be that viral element alone, but it's lots of other stuff and environmental factors and lifestyle factors too.
So still, get your vaccines from about the age of 50 onwards because it's going to be good for your brain.
Also in the new statins. Now, I think there's a lot of confusion about statins and I feel like they get a bad rap, Norman, because often when I suggest them to patients where there's a really good clinical indication, because there is a lot of robust evidence that these medications can reduce your risk of having a heart attack if you're high risk, if you've already had a heart attack or a stroke.
Before you go on, for those 25-year-old listeners, of which there are many, and you've never heard of a statin, one day you might need one because your cholesterol goes up, and these are the commonest cholesterol-reducing drugs around.
Yes, and I think we need to acknowledge they got a really bad rap in about 2013 due to some research that was published at the time. And then there was also a Catalyst episode that was aired on statins, and it led to a significant number, more than 60,000 Australians actually cutting back or completely stopping their statin therapy. And it likely that led to actually preventable heart attacks and strokes. They're estimating in the thousands. These medications, statins, robust evidence that in specific people, they really do help reduce the risk of heart disease. So if you're high risk, you've got certain types of kidney disease, really strong genetic cholesterol disorders, these medications may actually save your life, but they get a bad rap, Norman.
And there's a whole list of side effects that are on the back of the packet or on the patient sheet. So from liver damage to muscle pains and aches and muscle damage to cognitive impairment to diabetes.
It's a very long list, but thank goodness there are researchers that have just published in The Lancet who have actually looked at, are these listed side effects? Is there actually evidence that the drug causes them?
So the list is 66 long, so
wow.
66 different side effects. So they've looked at data from 123, nearly 124,000 people. And what they found is of the 66 side effects, only four were significant. So that is muscle problems, so you can get muscle aches and pains, that your liver enzymes, so this is like, if you like, a biochemical measure of your liver function, which goes up rather than you falling apart with liver failure. It's just that the liver function tests go up. A higher risk of diabetes, it's a small raised risk of diabetes. Edema, which is another one of the studies, in other words, swelling of the ankles. So maybe we should just talk about this in terms of the excess risk. So if you are not having statins, what would be your chances of the side effect versus what would be your added risk if you were on statins? I think that's the easiest thing to describe for people. So if you actually take the rise in liver function tests, if you weren't on statins over the period of time of this study in this age group of people, 556 people would actually have a rise in liver function tests, no matter what, just because of life.
Mm.
783 had a rise in liver function tests due to statin therapy. So another 220-odd people over a period of 4 years or 5 years would have got an increase in their liver function tests. So that just gives you an idea of the excess from statins. So all the others didn't show up when you actually did the study. Of the four that did show up, it was a small increase in risk.
And I think the takeaway is a lot of the symptoms that people often worry about that are currently listed, so things like brain fog, cognitive impairment, sleep disturbance, peripheral neuropathy, the data just doesn't support it. And there's a push now to change the labelling to better reflect the results of this study so that people don't read about the side effects potentially and then attribute them to the statin.
And this is called the nocebo effect.
Read the side effects and you're likely to get them, Norman.
That's
I often
right.
say this.
And what would be a health report without a GLP-1 story? So this week's GLP-1 story is what, Priya?
This week's GLP-1 story is looking at the nutritional deficiencies that can happen if you're on a GLP-1. Now, this is between 2017 and 2021, and I think we need to acknowledge it was a different landscape then.
Now and different drugs.
Different drugs. So the ones included in this study were dulaglutide, semaglutide and liraglutide. So semaglutide is Ozempic, people might know it as the brand name. Now we've got tirzepatide, which is Mounjaro, completely different entity, and people are now on these meds without type 2 diabetes for weight management. So it is a different landscape, but I think it's given us an interesting insight into what can happen on these medications.
So what they showed was that the commonest deficiency was vitamin D, which they think is because fat cell metabolism is affected. And you want to hear about fat cell metabolism, we'll have a link to our fat cell program a couple of weeks ago. And muscle loss.
Yes, and actually over 20% of the people who are on the GLP-1 had nutritional deficiencies diagnosed within 1 year of starting the GLP-1. And muscle loss was also seen in 3% of the patients who were on these medications within a year. And that is why I bang on about the wraparound care that's needed if you're prescribing these meds. Like I'm talking to patients about resistance training, protein intake, and ideally if they can afford it, involving an exercise physiologist and dietitian. But a reminder that these meds are not risk-free.
And just a caveat about that study, it was based on claims data in a US healthcare system. So it's only people they saw and who claimed for these tests or seeing a dietitian and so on. So you've not got, you haven't got a really good view on what happens overall. But, you know, these are data that have been lacking in other studies.
Can I just say one other interesting thing, Norma, that I...
You always say interesting things.
Well, it really changed my perspective. I hadn't thought about this as a clinician, that these authors actually said there's a potential concern about thirst, the suppression of thirst, which could actually lead to dehydration in vulnerable older patients.
I didn't see that.
But that was a thing that I went, oh my goodness, I hadn't actually uniquely thought about fluid intake and dehydration. So that's just another element.
On ABC Radio National, we've just given you another thing to worry about here on the Health Report. So let's get into exercise and mental health. You probably already prescribe exercise for people with mental health issues.
My patients see it on their mental health plan, or I often put it on a little piece of paper, Norman. I love prescribing it, and time in nature.
Now, I thought this was a done deal, that exercise can be used either to prevent or treat depression and anxiety. But in fact, a huge new review, we call it an umbrella systematic review and a meta-analysis, just means it's bloody big.
Super research.
So it's a group of researchers, largely Australian researchers, who've crunched the data even further to tie down the relationship between depression and anxiety and exercise, but exercise as therapy, pretty much like exercise is now therapy in cancer. The news was good, but it has some nuances. Here's the first author, Neil Munro, from James Cook University.
What we found with other studies that have been done in the past at a similar level is that some of the populations included had concurrent conditions as well. For example, some of the audience or the participants may be suffering from a heart condition or any form of chronic disease.
So the exercise might have been making the chronic disease better, and that would have made you feel psychologically better, secondarily.
Yes, and the motivation as well. You know, you go to the doctor and diagnose with diabetes, for example, then your motivation to exercise might be just to overcome that. What we wanted to do with our study is clearly identify studies that have honed in on exercise for depression and anxiety without confounding conditions.
But just before we get to the results, to explore the basics, because when you do these big reviews, it's all dependent on the quality of the individual studies that you bring together.
Absolutely.
And it's very hard to have a placebo for exercise. So how good were the studies in the first place?
They were all randomized controlled trials.
So what's the placebo for exercise?
It would depend on the individual study. So certain groups will be given certain types of exercise and certain groups will be given different ones. So, for example, one of the component studies that we picked out, some of the audience would have been told to exercise as per their normal routine and some would have been told to exercise at a different intensity or do a different type of exercise. So what the component studies identified was the exact impact of the prescription of exercise without the audience or the participant, should I say, knowing exactly what was given to them.
So what you've been able to do in the results of this study is refine just where the benefits really are or who benefits most. Why don't you just walk us through what you found?
What we found for exercise for depression, all different types of exercise, or certainly the three main categories we looked at, which were aerobic exercise, resistance training, and mind-body, so things like yoga, Pilates, and so on. Out of all of those, aerobic exercise had a high impact. Resistance training and mind-body training, or mixed training exercise formats, had a medium impact. So pretty good news across the board. Alongside that, we also found that supervised exercise and group exercise activities had a significantly high impact as well over and above individual exercise. What we suspect might be going on there is the social components of exercise, being around other people, things like group Zumba classes, running classes, swimming, whatever, that can have an additional compound impact.
And you also saw that some groups of people benefited more than others.
Yeah, the biggest impacts were seen for people aged between 18 to 30. That's not to say other age groups had a low impact, but there was a higher impact for that age group.
In other words, it's additive on top of the impact, the baseline impact.
Absolutely. Also, very importantly, for postnatal females, we saw a significantly higher impact as well. So exercise to help potentially with postnatal depression, obviously considering the nature of the individual, exercise can have a significant impact there.
So in the past, the recommendation, I'll come to anxiety in a moment, the recommendation for depression is that to get the effect, it actually has to be at least moderate intensity. Mild exercise doesn't cut it. You've got to work hard at the exercise. Did you find that in this review?
Not really for depression. Exercise of any nature can have an impact. Now, that's going to sound like a real generalization. What we believe is the most important point is exercise that's suitable for the individual circumstances and what's going to motivate them to exercise. So,
because motivation is a major issue if you've got depression.
Absolutely. And identifying what's going to work for that individual. Some of the studies, I mean, if people are living in a real regional area without access to decent gyms or whatever, saying to someone, go and do some weights in a group class might not work. So it's individual circumstances, individual motivations, we believe is the most important aspect.
What about anxiety?
A slightly different picture emerged for anxiety. So medium effects across the board for different exercise formats. So whether or not that was weight training, swimming, running, whatever. Probably the most important or significant thing that we saw was that for anxiety, shorter periods of exercise, and when I say shorter periods, it's up to an 8-week period. And also...
So it's not the individual sessions, it's how long you go on for.
So the duration of the program. And also, interestingly, we're certainly going to pursue this further, lower impact exercise can work for anxiety as well. So when we say lower impact, that's the more gentle forms, things like walking, for example, or walking at a brisk pace, swimming exercises that may get your heart rate up a little bit, but not massively intensive.
There's been some evidence that being outdoors, pounding around the streets versus running in the park, for example, that that's better for your mental health, notwithstanding what you're saying is that any exercise is good if you're able to take it. Did you look at where the exercise took place?
We didn't have the data that indicated that at the level we was looking for. But it's a very interesting angle to explore. I mean, the whole world of environmental psychology is a field that could be explored.
Depression often goes along with anxiety. Anxiety often goes along with depression. In fact, it's unusual to find somebody who's purely depressed, purely anxious. What happened when you had both?
For the scope of our study, we just looked at the individual aspects. So some studies that focused on depression only and studies that focused on anxiety only.
So, I mean, in terms of a practical takeaway for somebody listening, and you had depression and anxiety, you might want to think about which one is more dominant. If it's depression, you might want to head for more heavier duty exercise. And if anxiety is dominant, then you might want to go a little bit light.
Yeah, potentially. I mean, the phrase no pain, no gain that sometimes you hear bandied about, we don't believe that that message in itself is meaningful. And our key message essentially would be work with your GP, your therapist, your counsellor, whoever you're close to in helping with your psychological symptoms and work out an exercise plan that's going to work for your own motivations and your individual circumstances.
So the other key finding from this study is that it's up there as an equal intervention for depression and anxiety with psychotherapy and medication. How certain are you of that finding?
Our findings just looked at the exercise outcomes, and then what we compared this to were studies that did a similar meta-analytical umbrella review that's looked at psychotherapies and also pharmaceutical treatment. And the aggregation of the data from those studies elsewhere seemed to show comparable outcomes to exercise. So I guess we're trying to encourage the debate that exercise could be seen as a complementary prescription for people suffering depression or anxiety symptoms that could help supplement and or work alongside existing treatments with antidepressants and CBT and so on.
So it's a bit like cancer to integrate it much more into an expectation in the formal therapy regime.
Absolutely, absolutely. And that's what we're trying to encourage with this study, that exercise can work, and how can this fit into a potential prescription plan for someone suffering with the symptoms.
Neil, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Neil Munro is at James Cook University. We'll have the link to that study, as we do for all our studies, on our website.
I do find that if I do something vigorous, if I'm feeling particularly anxious, I feel a bit better.
I feel a lot better.
Yeah. So it's just nice to know that all of it is backed by evidence.
Yep. You know, get on my bike into work, go down for a swim, you know, there's all sorts of things.
You should definitely keep moving with us, because you're on the Health Report on ABC Radio National.
Fortunately, as each year goes by, about 1% or 2% fewer people have a fatal heart attack in Australia, which is fantastic news. But it's still one of the commonest causes of death in Australia. And plenty of people get heart attacks and don't die. And if you don't die, what treatment do you have to prevent the next one? That's a matter of huge debate, and we're going to be covering it shortly here on the Health Report.
I think people will be aware that there's been a lot more discussion in the media recently about the options and choices when it comes to birth in Australia. Been a lot more around free birth, Norman, and home birthing, and some tension there, and the tragic death of an influencer who was an advocate for free birth.
So it's really controversial.
It is. It is. And in Victoria, there's been a new framework released which tries to help clinicians with respectful maternal and newborn care. And it's really meant to be for those scenarios where a pregnant woman chooses not to necessarily follow the clinical recommendations or the clinician's advice, and to do what they think is right for them and their baby. I spoke to Dr. Nisha Cott, who's an obstetrician in Victoria and president of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists, and I started by asking why this framework was even needed in the first place.
We have somehow gotten into, not always, but many times we have gotten into this framework of saying to women, you should have this because this is what a policy or a guideline says. Now, we know that the reason a policy or a guideline says that you should have XYZ, for example, have an induced labor, is because there are risks that go with continuing the pregnancy beyond a certain point. We are not telling women this. We are telling women, let's do it because a policy says it. And that isn't enough for women to make a decision. Women want to know, why does the policy say this particular thing? Mm. How does this policy apply to me and my situation, as opposed to every woman who has my risk factor, for example? And that is what this framework does. It gives us a way of having those conversations so that women and families can understand why we are making certain recommendations.
There's been a lot of public tension recently with movements around home birthing, free birthing. There's also been the very tragic death of an influencer recently. Is this framework hoping to address this element as well? Because people appear to be turning away from conventional medical therapy, or, you know, some people. Is this trying to tackle that?
Yes, it definitely is, because all the research, and I should acknowledge that we don't have a whole lot of research, but the research we have tells us that the reason people turn away from medical care is because they feel disrespected, they feel unheard, and this is a way of making sure that we provide that respect and we listen to people and acknowledge their concerns, their values, their priorities for their care. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be recommending things that we know are the best intervention to have in a particular situation, but it means that we frame them around the person in front of us and we frame them around their priorities rather than our own priorities as clinicians.
You used the example of the induction of labour. So let's say, and in the document, that's one of the case studies, that someone is 41 weeks pregnant. They are recommended induction of labour because of the risks, potentially higher risk of stillbirth and other things. Can you talk us through what it looks like if we use this framework? So the patient says, I don't want to be induced. The clinician says, but wait a minute, the risks are high. What does using this framework look like practically in the real world?
using this framework practically would mean, one, for the clinician to have a discussion with the woman. When we say that there are higher risks of stillbirth, we as clinicians sometimes don't understand numbers, and certainly women and families don't understand numbers. What does higher actually mean? And I think giving people numbers to say your risk of having a stillbirth on a population level, for example, is 1 in 10,000 at 40 weeks, it's 2 in 10,000 at 41 weeks, and it's 3 in 10,000 at 42 weeks. These are numbers. Yeah. These can be, you know, understood sensibly rather than saying a higher risk. And this will help a woman make a decision that works for her. And I often in my conversations will say 1 in 10,000, 2 in 10,000 really doesn't mean much when it happens to me. When it happens to me, it is 1 in 1. And so we have to take the numbers as they apply to large populations, which is the research we have, and then think about what it means for us as individuals. And if we feel that actually a risk of 1 in 10,000 versus 2 in 10,000 is a risk I wouldn't take, then yes, having an induction is the right thing to do. That, I think, is a really important way of framing the conversation, because I could very easily say that the risk is double, because it is double. One versus two is double the risk. And when I say it's double the risk, that sounds scary. And it sounds like I'm trying to sway someone to make a decision that may not be the decision they want to make. And that can be seen as being coercive. It's not being coercive, it's being honest, because it is double the risk. But actually providing the numbers will help frame that doubling of risk to someone and help them make a decision without feeling like they're being forced into making a decision they don't want to make.
So it's about giving more accessible, digestible information to people so they can make an informed health decision. And even if, Nisha, this framework appears to suggest the patient doesn't want to go with the clinical guidelines or the clinician advice, that must be respected.
Yes, absolutely. Ultimately, we can't do anything to anyone without their consent, because that would be assault. And none of us want to do anything without consent.
I wonder, Nisha, this framework is there. I read through it as a practicing clinician, and I saw things like shared decision-making, active listening, helping patients make informed decisions without pressure. I wonder, should that not be implicit, just absolutely expected in medicine? And is it somewhat disheartening that a document like this is needed? I just wondered how you feel about that.
I think this is the sort of practice that we all want to do. But we have to also acknowledge that this kind of active listening, shared decision making takes time. And the way our health system works, especially a public health system, we don't have the time. Let's be realistic. Most patients I see in my antenatal clinic, I have somewhere between 15 to 20 minutes to see them in. And that 15 to 20 minutes isn't going to be enough for me to do all of those things while also addressing a whole lot of other things. For example, high blood pressure, blood sugars, baby's movements, listening to the baby's heartbeat, measuring the baby's bump, checking the blood pressure. These are lots and lots of things to do within that small time frame. And again, it brings back the fact that medicine can't be timed. We have to have place for slow medicine. We have to have place for having those conversations that build trust. Because ultimately, anything we do in medicine is about relationships. And the only way we can build relationships is when we have time, we have the ability to have those discussions, we have the ability to provide continuity of care so that we build that relationship over time.
And do you think that's perhaps where influencers who advocate for perhaps non-conventional methods, pregnancy care, birthing methods, they have the luxury of time perhaps?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, as an influencer, you can do a one-hour podcast if you wanted to and talk about the things that matter to you. And someone listening to it would go, well, here's someone who's taken a whole hour to explain the process of, for example, induction to me and tell me all about the things that can go wrong and go badly. Whereas the doctor I saw yesterday told me this in 5 minutes and did not give me any of the details because they were so busy talking about other things. So yes, we have to acknowledge that, you know, sometimes influencers not only have the time, but they also don't have the constraints of having any kind of regulatory framework. They can't be held accountable, so they can say whatever they like, wherever they like, and there is no accountability, no one to check or provide a fact check on what they're saying. Whereas as clinicians, whether it is midwives, doctors, allied health clinicians, we are all bound by a code of conduct and we have to abide by it.
Dr. Nisha Kot, President of the Royal Australian and New Zealand College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists.
But Priya, it still raises the question of how assertive you should be with a woman who's embarking on something that you, the data would show, is really risky, you know, going off into the middle of nowhere with an unqualified person and saying, well, this is what they do in Africa, why wouldn't we do it here?
I think
I mean, you can't stop them.
No, you can't. But I think, as Nisha says, there's an issue here. So how do we get people to engage and hopefully consider the evidence-based options with qualified health professionals to keep them and their baby safe?
And to make a declaration about where I'm coming from is, you know, I trained in pediatrics many, many years since I've actually practiced. So I'd be a very dangerous pediatric practitioner now. But when you're training in pediatrics, you're on call for the worst deliveries, you know, so you know how many babies you've saved by just being there and being able to suck out the airway and doing a little bit of ventilation and the baby comes good. And you think, oh God, you would not want this to happen in the middle of nowhere.
Can I, at the time of recording, Norman, actually, and this is all very topical, this is how onto it we are on the health report, in the state of Tasmania, which is where I was born, they're actually...
You're Tasmanian. Yeah,
I've never declared
that. Tell me this now.
It's the most beautiful place, I think, ever. But anyway, and the best oysters. However, in Tasmania, they're just looking at allowing public hospital midwives to help with home births to try and empower women. Clearly, there's a demand for this, and they're trying to actually provide qualified health professionals who can make the situation safer. And I think trying to bridge this gap that we're talking about, trying to retain people in the system if they can. So, I mean, that's an interesting thing that I'm watching very closely in Tasmania. Will other states follow suit?
Australia is only 50 years behind the times. I trained in Aberdeen in the northeast of Scotland, and they had a formal home birth program with a flying squad that if a midwife got into problems, the flying squad actually came out and assisted the midwife.
Oh, so wow. Like paediatrician, obstetrician?
Mostly obstetrician, who were trained, obviously, in paediatric resuscitation with a midwife. So they came out and they had O negative blood, so that the mother needed blood, they got it. And but risk adjusted. So the woman really did not qualify and was too high a risk that they were brought into the main centre, but quite safe.
Wow. Maybe we're headed there. You never know.
You're with the Health Report here on ABC Radio National.
There's been, I think, some conflicting headlines in the media about a class of medications called beta blockers, which people might have heard of. They can manage your blood pressure. They slow your heart rate down. Some people use them for performance anxiety. Maybe you've used some before the studio today, Norman.
I'm always anxious when I come up. But I haven't tried a beta blocker. I have in the past. They made me feel crap.
Well, there you go. So often they're used in people who have had a heart attack because they can reduce the amount of oxygen and blood that the heart muscle actually needs. So they can take some of the pressure off. They can help regulate the heart rate and the blood pressure. People might have seen headlines about beta blockers being bad for women and actually causing harm, that they're actually the best drug you could be on. And it's actually very nuanced. And so we thought, why don't we get to the bottom of it all and speak to an expert? And the person I spoke with is Professor Jason Kovacic, who's a cardiologist and director of the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute.
The data supporting beta blocker use goes back to the early 1980s. But data going back that far clearly showed that beta blockers can reduce the rates of major cardiovascular problems in people after a heart attack. And there was a lot of data back in that era to support that. So that led to the widespread use and recommendations for beta blockers after heart attack that's carried on until these recent studies were published.
So then there's been this kind of, and that's what you're alluding to, these recent studies, these conflicting headlines that people might have seen, some suggesting that beta blockers in women after a heart attack could be harmful, other headlines suggesting that research shows that they're of benefit. What is the takeaway, Jason? Where are we at when it comes to beta blockers?
We've moved on and it's fantastic. There's been just such amazing progress in how we treat heart attack since those early beta blocker studies were done. So the way we diagnose, the way we do coronary artery stenting, we take people to the catheterization laboratory, we open block arteries. The people that have had a heart attack now in 2026 are very different to the people that had a heart attack in, you know, 1980. They're not as unwell. Survival rates are better. So it's a really a different era. So that led to these clinical trials of beta blockers being done. And there were two of these really big clinical trials presented at the European Society of Cardiology meeting. One was conducted in Spain and Italy. The other was conducted in Norway and Denmark, really designed to look at the role of beta blockers in the contemporary era, but particularly in people that had relatively preserved or close to normal cardiac function.
Okay, so that's people who they still have a very effective heart pump that's able to pump blood out to the rest of the body.
So to take you through the data, and it is really important to unpack this, in the meta-analysis of those with mildly reduced cardiac function after a heart attack, patients still benefited from beta blocker therapy. And there was a reduction in what we call the overall outcome of the study, which was all causes of death, new heart attack, or cardiac failure. So the role of beta blockers actually in those with mildly reduced cardiac function was shown to be beneficial. What really will change practice, though, is that when they looked at patients with normal heart function after a heart attack, they actually found that there was no change in people that were having beta blockers or not having beta blockers. And that finding will change the way we use beta blockers in that we've now shown they're of no value in people with normal heart function after heart attack.
So as opposed to it being just about gender, which some of the headlines did say beta blockers, women after heart attack harm, is it a bit more nuanced, Jason, that it's actually about the heart function as well that needs to be taken into account?
It is more nuanced, and full credit to all of the investigators involved in these studies. They decided to bring all the data together and do what's called a meta-analysis, where we effectively put the study data together, combine everything so we have thousands of patients and we can analyze the data as an aggregate. And you're right, in one of the studies, there were some signals that women could actually be harmed by beta blocker therapy. And there were some other signals related to age. But when all the data was put together, that signal of harm in women fell away.
Okay, so when all the data was combined with the really big numbers, that signal kind of disappeared. Just picking up on women here, Jason, there is a lot of research showing that when it comes to heart disease, ischemic heart disease, heart attacks, that women often have a delay in receiving certain life-saving procedures. They may be later to be diagnosed with some sort of ischemic heart disease or a heart attack. The outcomes are different for women. Is that changing?
There's been a problem in our society right across the spectrum in terms of how we approach women with heart disease. It's traditionally thought of as a men's disease, older men, but heart disease doesn't discriminate. It certainly affects women and it affects premenopausal women. Premenopausal women can have heart attacks as well. We need to do a better job across our society in educating everybody that women and even younger women can and do suffer from heart attacks. We need to be better at diagnosing and managing it in our hospitals. And one of the biggest challenges is that we haven't included enough women in our clinical trials, and particularly premenopausal women with heart attack in our clinical trials. So there's also a lack of really good clinical data to optimally guide how we treat women. And at the moment, we pretty much still use the same treatments after heart attack in men versus women. But I am pretty sure, although I don't have data to prove it, I'm pretty sure that there are significant biological differences in heart attack in men versus women, that ultimately we will get down to sex-specific therapies for men versus women so that we can really focus in on the what are the true drivers of heart attack in men versus women, because it is different.
Professor Jason Kovacic, Director and CEO of the Victor Chang Cardiac Research Institute and cardiologist at St Vincent's Hospital in Sydney.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Health Report. So what's in the mailbag?
So we did an extensive show last week on non-GP specialist fees in Australia, climbing and the reasons for that.
And your out-of-pocket costs associated.
And we've had a significant quantity of responses. Don has written in saying, I have a small SCC, so that's a squamous cell cancer, a skin cancer on my ear, so very small, 2 millimetres wide and 2 millimetres deep. I went to a surgeon who quoted day surgery with a skin graft at $3,000 before about $800 was going to be rebated from his private insurance. I told some of my friends and several of them said they had a similar surgery at a much lower cost and gave me the names of a couple of the surgeons they'd used. I had a consult with one of the alternative surgeons who also recommended day surgery with a skin graft at one of Sydney's best private hospitals. Cost zero, no out-of-pocket cost at all. The surgeon told me this was a very straightforward procedure that would take less than an hour. I contacted the first surgeon's office and told the practice nurse the surgeon was ripping me off.
Oh, brave, brave stuff.
You've got some empowerment from Norman and I, hopefully. I then got a call from this surgeon who spent quite a while justifying his price. He then sent me a very long email. What really upset him was that I intended to put a review on Google stating I got an alternative quote for a fraction of his cost. I will note that I'm sure he's a very good, highly experienced and qualified surgeon. Hopefully I will not be successfully sued for defamation. I'm considering how to set up a social media page to share low-cost surgeons' names. Well, that's the whole intention, Don, of the Cost Finder website, hopefully. Maybe you don't need the social media profile.
Let's hope.
Save yourself the time.
Keep your finger on the button, though.
You know. You never know.
And Emma writes, I was seeing a gynecologist in my regional city and was needing a hysterectomy. I was going to be $4,000 to $7,000 out of pocket, even with my private health insurance. She was also not prepared to help with another surgery at the same time. I got a referral to another gynecologist in a larger city and got a more experienced and better surgeon who was able to do all the surgery for an out-of-pocket of $500. Crazy difference. Mm-hmm. Living regionally is definitely a disadvantage.
And I do think, though, Emma, even in a metropolitan centre, you might see that discrepancy, as we've just heard from Don. Unfortunately, yeah, regional is an added element again. Jenny's written in, recently I had complex surgery with a gynecologist. I had private hospital cover and needed to travel to Hobart for the procedure. My health fund had paid approximately $10,000 for the surgery and a five-night hospital stay. I was given a comprehensive quote prior by the hospital, the surgeon and the anaesthetist. However, I was not informed that a second surgeon's fee would be $800 on top of the health fund excess fee. I'm fortunate to have savings to pay these fees, but I'm very concerned about the widening gap in healthcare availability for people with low incomes. You should have been advised of that fee beforehand.
Bill writes, an issue that gets forgotten with private health insurance is that the funds are legally unable to cover care outside a hospital or registered procedure centre. This includes consultations and other care. This is particularly anachronistic now that so much care is provided in the community. A particular issue you raised was with radiation therapy. This is not covered because it's deemed outpatient care. This could be fixed by amending the Private Health Insurance Act, which is something the private health insurance industry has been arguing for. Although some private health insurers, although I'm not here to argue the case, do provide community-based care, but it's on their account. They don't charge you for it. So, for example, rather than being admitted to, let's say you've had a knee replacement, rather than being admitted to a rehabilitation inpatient service, you'll get home-based rehabilitation, which the private health insurer will pay for. So, you know, they do get around it a little bit. But, you know, they would love to get involved in general practice, for example, but that's a whole other story.
We have loved all of your emails and we hope that we provided some insight into the issue and the complexities of it. Please write into us. We love it. healthreport@abc.net.au is our address.
And don't forget our sister podcast, Watch That Rash. And this week we answer the question, is doing nothing good for you?
I'll do nothing till I see you next week then, hey? I'll give it a go.
That's right. But it does involve sleep.
Yes.
You've got to have your eyes open when you're doing nothing.
At all times. All right. I'll be tired next week. I'll see you then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.